And now, I see squared with Jimmy Cavanaugh.
Back on IC Squared, folks. Thanks for sticking with us. Jimmy Cavanaugh joined this week by a contributor on IndySportsLegends.com, Chris Goff. You might know him as @PacersScribe. Chris, thanks for coming on the show. Good to have a member of the ISL Mafia.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jimmy. I really appreciate it.
Well, it should be fun. The honor is all mine because the fact that, A, you started following me last week was big for my self-esteem, and B, the fact that you guys have been very consistent contributing source of Pacers information through what's normally a dead period, the NBA offseason. Basically, you have to manufacture stories, and you guys have done an outstanding job of doing that in the best way possible.
Yeah, I appreciate that. It's a really, really slow time right now if you're an NBA fan. You know, if you're not into college recruiting, if you're not into college football, there's not much for you to do. So we try to keep content every week, and our Pacers stuff always does really well. And, you know, there aren't actually that many media outlets out there that cover the Pacers. So we've got a pretty good following. And, hey, I'm happy to follow you. I'm a man of the people, and I'm glad to see you join Indy Cornrows. The podcast has been a nice addition to what was already a good website, so congratulations on that launch,
which
has also happened during this sort of down period that you're referring to, the dog days of the NBA, as I call them.
Yeah, we're compatriots. I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine. Everyone who's listening, check out Indy Sports Legends. It's great. Cliff is great, and so is Chris. Let's get into it really quick. Yeah, just talking about the offseason and how there are very limited storylines as my phone goes off here in the makeshift studio. Cliff wrote something last week that I thought was interesting. We got into it on Twitter a little bit, asking about the Granger Born Ready question. Cliff posited that Danny Granger was the right guy to start. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. And we talked about it back and forth. I haven't gotten to ask you your take yet.
Here's my take. Paul George is absolutely the future of the franchise. And what they do with that shooting guard position should be whatever is best for Paul George. If he feels more comfortable at small forward, which he's indicated, I've been around him a few times where he seemed to indicate that he is more comfortable at the three rather than at the two, which he played as an NBA sophomore, then I think you should start Lance Stephenson, keep things the same. If Paul George is okay with going back to the shooting guard, he definitely can guard shooting guards. That's not an issue. He has the quickness. He has the lateral movement. He can guard pretty much any position on the floor as far as a wing. But if offensively he's more comfortable at small forward, playing in that intermediate area, not doing as much ball handling, we've seen the turnovers are a problem, then I think you should stick with Lance and bring Danny off the bench and help that second unit. I have no idea which way the Pacers are going to go because you've heard them make noises both ways, right? Donnie Walsh, Larry Bird, Kevin Pritchard, and maybe not Bird. I don't know if I've heard Bird's take on this issue, but Frank Vogel has definitely mentioned the possibility of bringing Granger or Stevenson off the bench. Either one is capable of starting. I don't think there's a wrong answer. Yes, they built a lot of chemistry last year with that starting five, but let's be real, if you add Danny Granger in as a small forward and put Paul George at shooting guard, you have, Jimmy, one of the biggest starting wing combinations in NBA history. I mean, those guys are just huge. Danny Granger is big for his position. Paul George would just be a monster as a he's virtually 6'10" at shooting guard. A big wingspan. He rebounds like a power forward. I mean, defensively, that would just be a nightmare. So it may take them a while to adjust to playing with one another again. Are there enough shots to go around with that starting five? I don't know, because you have five really good options in the starting lineup if you add Granger back in. But it would work. Starting Stevenson would work. So I'm not too concerned about that. I realize that's one of the issues that's interesting to people. You know, Lance has said, hey, I'm open to coming off the bench. Whether he's still saying that in September and October in a contract year, we'll see. But I'm more concerned about the bench as a whole and how it gels offensively. Stevenson or Granger can add scoring in that spot. So it's an interesting debate, but I don't think the Pacers' season is going to turn one way or the other based on which decision they make.
I agree with you that I don't think they can make a wrong decision necessarily, because I think both of them could be decent. But as somebody who's been in the Stevenson camp, Cliff's writing made me think in a way that no one's really addressed it yet. The central points being the idea that Lance Stevenson, the best he played all last year was in the playoffs. In the postseason, he averaged 9 points and 8 rebounds a game. He was a really solid rebounder for his position, too. But he shot 41%, and this is as the fifth option on that starting unit. And then you look at Danny Granger, who gets all this flack from being a shot chucker, a hunter for, you know, his points individually on teams that needed him to do that. The worst he ever shot was a couple seasons ago when he shot 42%. So Stevenson in the playoffs did not shoot as well as Danny Granger did in his worst shooting season. And also going back to a couple years ago when the Pacers finally broke through, they played the Heat in the second round. Granger was the leading scorer on that team, averaged 19 points, and this is with David West and Danny and Roy Hibbert contributing scoring too with 12.8 points per game. So Granger, in the role of the Pacers are asking him to be, I think we could agree that he would be a second or third option even in that starting unit now, maybe even four behind Roy Hibbert. But looking at what Lance Stevenson was able to do in that role, I'm not sure if Danny Granger could not be a lot more efficient. And then looking at Lance going to the bench and asked to do more, is it possible his shooting percentage goes down as he's asked to manufacture a little more and make more decisions?
Yeah, it's an interesting point that you raise. I'm actually of the mind that he might be the rare player who is better off the bench. As a rule, most guys, their shooting percentages, their overall effectiveness goes down when they come off the bench versus what they're able to do as starters. But with Stevenson, look at what he, as you said, he's a fifth option in the starting lineup, which, what does that mean? Well, Hibbert and West are getting double teamed quite a bit. Paul George is getting the ball with chances to create offense. George Hill's running the show. That pretty much means Stevenson is getting opportunities in transition, or in the half court, he's mostly a spot-up player, which is the weakest part of his game. He's not a good three-point shooter. He started out really well last year, but then he faded back to, you know, about 33%, which is below average. So off the bench, he's going to have the ball in his hands with a chance to create and get to the basket, where he's very effective. He's a great finisher, one of the best finishing shooting guards in the NBA, actually. So I think you make the argument that Stevenson would be better off the bench. And Granger, obviously, he's never come off the bench in his career. I think the biggest adjustment for him would be possibly the reduced minutes, because if he goes to like 24 minutes a game, I mean, that's about a quarter less than he's used to. That would be a big change for him. I'm sort of not sure what Granger is going to bring because of his knee injury. You know, that's sort of the X factor in this whole discussion is his knee going to be healthy? If you recall, he fell to the Pacers. He was drafted at 17 in the first round out of 30 picks, obviously. He's proven he's played above his draft position.
He was better than Yaroslav Korolev. He outplayed him right off the bat.
The Clippers are still regretting that one all these years later. But, of course, the Clippers regret a lot of things. That franchise is just, ugh. But, you know, one of the reasons that Granger did fall is concerns about his knee. And we've seen with guys like Greg Oden and Brandon Roy, sometimes if you have knee issues, they just eventually just swamp everything else. And I'm not saying that's going to happen with Danny. He's held up pretty well. But he's been a sort of an injury guy in his career. And I don't know if it's going to be 100. It's not full strength right now. We know that. Will it be full strength by the start of the season? And then can it maintain? Can that knee that he had the surgery on maintain full strength throughout the year? I don't know. That's a question mark for me.
Yeah, I don't want to get out of this podcast without having discussed this in full, because I've touched on it with everyone who I've had on to start this series, and everyone's had a different take about the Danny Granger-Lance Stephenson dynamic. It's the main thing that I'm keeping my eye on, because like you said before, it's not going to be the thing that makes the season, because, as you know, Frank Vogel can decide to change his rotation as we go throughout the year. But that being said, it's about trying to get off to as quick a start as possible and acclimating everybody to what their role is going to be, trying to prepare them for the playoffs. That's what they're playing towards. And if I'm looking at this team in a playoff series, it seems to me the idea of Lance Stephenson being called upon to carry the bench for periods of time can get a little dangerous. I think there's the flip side where Lance is not as comfortable playing in the starting five as the fifth guy with what his role has been traditionally, you know, from his Born Ready days down in Coney Island. But on the flip side, I don't know if we want Lance Stephenson feeling comfortable being Born Ready from Coney Island, playing street ball as the lead option on that Pacers bench with guys like Luis Scola and Chris Copeland and C.J. Watson also available. I think there's a two-way dynamic there, which makes me a little nervous. I think Bad Lance, this is probably the way I'd put it, I think Bad Lance is more likely to show up if the Pacers end up bringing him off the bench and trying to get him to lead everybody from that position as a sixth or seventh man.
Oh, I understand that completely, because we still saw, you know, times in the playoffs where actually one game and one play specifically comes to my mind. The game that George Hill missed with the concussion in the Knicks series, they didn't use a backup point guard that night. They just went with Lance Stephenson.
Yeah, that didn't go so well.
No, it didn't go so well. There was one possession where he brought the ball up court. He didn't take one pass, and he took an off-balance mid-range jump shot, about the worst possible outcome you could have. And while obviously he's not going to be asked to run the offense on a regular basis, he once was considered maybe a point guard earlier in his career, but the Pacers, you know, tried that and realized it wasn't going to work out. But I see what you're saying, because off the bench he's going to be playing with lesser talents. He's going to stick out more. He's definitely going to be expected to do more this year after the year he had last year. And you don't want any of that going to his head. You want him in a controlled environment where, you know, he's allowed to be aggressive at times, but he's not going to try to go out of the system and break off plays to go get his own shot. I mean, he still has that in him. Like I said, it's a contract year. I don't know if he's going to be worried about that or not, if that's going to mess with his head. But I think there are some mitigating factors that make me sort of comfortable with him off the bench. And one of them is Luis Scola, okay? I think Scola is
If I can stop you there, I actually wanted to get right into that. And I'm glad that you brought up Luis Scola unprompted, because that was one of the poll questions that we had last week on Cornrows, accompanying that podcast, actually, asking people who the most important bench player was going to be. Two-thirds of them said either Danny Granger or Lance Stephenson, but Luis Scola was by far the next candidate. It was those two that garnered 80-85% of the voting. So is Luis Scola going to be that important? What's he going to bring specifically to this team? I feel like everybody knows that he's going to be a key contributor.
Oh, yeah. I actually think he's the Pacers. I don't know if I would characterize him as the go-to guy, but I think he's really going to be the glue for that second unit, because the main problem with the bench last season was offensively. There was a drop-off defensively, but it was much steeper offensively when they went to the bench to replace the starters. And Scola is just so solid. He can post up. He can shoot from mid-range. He can pass. I just think he'll be an anchor in that way that they didn't really have last year with any player. And he'll be expected to rebound, too, when Hibbert and West are out of the game. But because West is an older player, he'll be 33 this year, I think they're going to try to maybe reduce his minutes a little bit. And maybe even to the point where he's only playing 27 minutes a game, 28 minutes a game on average in the regular season. And Scola can fill in for those additional 20 minutes. That might be more than anybody else on the bench averages if Danny Granger stays healthy. So he's really going to be sort of the fulcrum of the offense on that second unit, and I think they'll run plays through him, much as they would David West if David West were in the game. You know, David West was the piece that made the Pacers' offense work last year, whether he was catching it in the post, whether he was catching it off pick and roll, and then making decisions, passing it out somewhere. I think Scola can just step right in. That's one of the great things about that acquisition is he's almost like a mini-me of David West. And so, you know, Stevenson goes to the bench, and he's not going to be asked to be, you know, Jamal Crawford or, you know, a Jason Terry in his prime, one of those guys who just, you know, flings it up every chance he gets because that's who he is. You know, the Pacers actually have options now. They have C.J. Watson to catch the ball on kickouts, very good three-point shooter. Mahimi should be a lot better this year. He had kind of a flukishly bad year offensively last year that I don't expect will repeat itself. Mahimi's a very good finisher. He can knock down 12-footers if you get him more involved. So I think the bench is going to be a lot better, first of all. It has the potential to be one of the best benches in the NBA. And Stevenson's going to find his way among that group of guys if he is, in fact, in that role. And then secondly, you know, Vogel has learned as a coach that you've got to do a good job of mixing bench and starters. You know, you don't want to run five bench guys out there on a regular basis. So, you know, I think you'll see a mix next season of bench and starters. And you never know what will happen with injuries. So I think to a degree the distinctions that are being made between, you know, who starts and who comes off the bench are a little bit what's the word I'm looking for?
You're saying they're a little overblown, I think. And I'm kind of with you just looking at how that's going to go in the playoffs. But when it comes to the regular season, Frank Vogel has a track record of going with those set rotations. He was the guy who brought the Goon Squad in its original iteration into being. I am excited about Luis Scola coming in. I'm actually on the same page as you about him being a David West offensive tie-in. I don't think he's anywhere near the defensive player he is, which makes me wonder about the role Jan Mahimi is going to play. I spoke a little bit about this last week with Tim Donahue and said that I think Jan Mahimi has a chance to be an X factor as far as this season goes along. You know, I don't think you expected me to say that coming into this podcast, but the fact that Mahimi can substitute for Hibbert and bring most of his defensive presence to the floor, and with this bench unit will not be asked to provide the same kind of offensive production, I think Jan can do a whole lot to anchor the defense and use the same concepts that they use when Hibbert's on the floor.
Yeah, the Pacers are very confident in him defensively, and that's one of the reasons that he was acquired, because they wanted another tall, you know, genuine center, not one of these power forward centers that you see so much in the NBA now. They wanted a shot blocker, an athlete, somebody who could replicate what Hibbert gives you as far as protecting the basket, deterring drives, you know, stuff like that. The biggest weakness, I guess, you would say, with Mahimi right now is that he fouls so much. He's, you know, on a per-minute basis, he's one of the worst hackers in the NBA. And he picks up an illegal screen every now and again, but obviously most fouls take place on defense. He's got to improve that if he ever hopes to move into a more involved role. But I'm absolutely with you that he can be a bigger factor this year offensively. I think he can draw fouls, and his true shooting percentage, which takes into account, you know, free throws and field goals and three-pointers. Jan doesn't shoot threes, but he's typically in his career had a really good true shooting percentage, and I don't have the data right in front of me, but I think he was like 10 points below his career average last year, which just makes no sense. And every once in a while, if you study NBA players' numbers on a year-to-year basis, you'll get outliers like that. And so that's why I think he'll be much better in that regard. I don't know if they'll run offense for him, but I think he'll pick up offense just by virtue of his athleticism, the fact that he's mobile. He's not going to be a passer. He's not going to play out on the perimeter or anything like that. But he's really athletic, and I think you'll see him make more of a presence in that way this year.
in the athleticism offensively, I don't think there's been a question. The fouls per game also worry me less than they might otherwise, because just looking at Roy Hibbert's numbers, that was always the question with him, and learning to foul less on a per-game basis. Last year, he actually tied his career high in fouls per game in about even minutes from what we've seen. He averaged 29 minutes a game, averaged 3.5 fouls per game. Jan played in the postseason fewer than 10 minutes a game and averaged almost 2 fouls. But in the postseason, when they stopped calling things and they got all that respect for going straight up, there are times when Jan was in the game where he was going straight up about as well as Roy Hibbert was and wasn't getting the attention just because no one knows who the Pacers are and who Jan Mahimi is. I still remember the people freaking out about the Darren Collison trade. Darren Collison ended up buried on the bench behind Derek Fisher by the end of the season. By midway through the season, the Mavs picked him up and demoted Darren Collison, and Jan was playing a central role in the Pacers' rotation, even into the playoffs, spelling Hibbert whenever he needed a rest. I think that, especially with his age, he's not an old guy. I think he's got a chance to play a central role, not only this year, but going forward. They control his rights for the next few years. He's only 26, and really comes at a premium and at a position where there aren't too many centers who can eat up space and go straight up on defense like that.
Yeah, they've got him under contract for the next 3 years and at $4 million a year for the price that they're paying. They should expect him to be an upper half backup center in the league, which is what I expected him to be when they signed him. I thought it was a good move. And Darren Collison's career, as you said, has really just taken a dramatic nosedive. I know he landed in Los Angeles with a good organization in the Clippers, but man, Jimmy, when you're getting beat out by Derek Fisher's corpse, that's when you really need to take a look in the mirror and say, what is happening here?
Yeah,
it doesn't get much worse than that, right?
Just about, I don't think. I'm trying to figure, because there are a few other things I wanted to talk about just with the roster, so we might as well go through the rest of the bench around Mahimi, who we talked about as a central defensive guy, and then Lance Stephenson and Louis Scola, who are the offensive guys. The rest of the glue looks like it's going to be C.J. Watson and Chris Copeland somewhere in there, with maybe Solomon Hill making an appearance here and there. Do we expect in the regular season that the rookie Solomon Hill is going to get a chance? Does Orlando Johnson have a chance to play anywhere? What do we see the offensive approach being? Is Lance Stephenson going to bring the ball up the floor? Is that going to go to C.J. Watson? I have a few questions about this just because there are so many new guys, and last year we saw them take some time to adjust. Is that a fair expectation for this year?
Yeah, I think so. It's going to be basically, with the exception of Mahimi, the unit's going to be entirely new. You know, no matter what they do with Granger and Stephenson, it's going to be four new guys in the rotation. I don't know about Solomon Hill. I didn't like that pick personally. I didn't get it. He wasn't a highly rated prospect at all. He didn't have any one thing that he did exceptionally well, but they love his defense, and most of the other acquisitions they made this offseason have been geared toward offense. Most of those guys, Watson, Copeland, Scola, are one-way players that don't help you and, in fact, probably hurt you on defense. So I understand that they wanted to add a defensive guy. Kevin Pritchard said from the minute he was drafted, you know, we think he can play this year. I believe that Frank Vogel has said the same thing, although I'd have to go back and look at my notes to verify that. But basically, the public stance of the Pacers has been that Hill will play. But I don't see the minutes, you know, short of an injury. I don't know how he plays, because this is already, he's a natural small forward. He's not a shooting guard. He's not a power forward. So, with Granger, Paul George on the team, I don't see how he's going to work in there for minutes.
Yeah, I'm trying to, I'm trying to figure out how Chris Copeland is going to get minutes, let alone Solomon Hill. I might as well ask you your thoughts on him before you get to OJ, because when the Pacers signed Copeland, that seemed to be the most polarizing thing they did all offseason outside of drafting Hill, because half people think that it means the Pacers are going to go to small ball. They're excited for the offense. They like the threes that he brought, and he was good in the Knicks series. But at the same time, he's only played one good year. He was a 27, 28-year-old rookie last season with no experience in the NBA outside of Mike Woodson's freewheeling run-and-gun system, which could not be further from what the Pacers are trying to do. What do you think about Copeland?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. It's going to be a very different system. You know, the Knicks look to get up three-pointers every chance they get, and the Pacers are only about, you know, league average as far as three-point attempts. So I think the biggest change might be, and this actually might benefit Chris Copeland, I was talking to his agent, and, you know, he just said, you know, yeah, he sort of struggled on defense, but look at the system he was playing in. The Knicks switch everything. They switch all their ball screens. So Copeland was ending up guarding, you know, point guards and small forwards and guys like that on switches. If he's in a system where he can just guard his man in a sort of more traditional way without having to switch to protect the interior like the Knicks did, he might have a chance to be more successful. But I agree, he doesn't have a track record, and his defensive metrics from last year are bad, whether it's a small forward, whether it's a power forward. He split time there. When he came over, Jimmy, I did not expect the Pacers to play small ball with him. I figured there was some other move in the works, or that Miles Plumlee was going to go into the rotation, because Frank Vogel just doesn't do it. I don't have lineup data in front of me, but I imagine that there's no team that sticks to traditional size at center and power forward throughout a game more than the Indiana Pacers do. And Chris Copeland, for all his strengths as a player, he's a wonderful shooter. He is not a traditional power forward. If he plays power forward, he's going to be a huge negative on the glass. So from what the team is now, it looks like he's going to be the backup small forward, and maybe sneak a few minutes in here and there at power forward. But I agree, for the price that they're paying for him, about $3 million a year, I'm not sure he's going to play as many minutes as you would expect for a guy that's making that kind of money. You know, maybe 15 to 18.
I think the best thing he has going for him at this point is the fact that he's not Gerald Green. And Gerald Green, that's who a lot of people compared him to, because Green had people legitimately excited. He was a high-flying dunker. He had just averaged double figures in New Jersey the year before and shot decent from three. I think people are a little worried about having that transition, because last year they bring in DJ Augustine for $3.5 million and Gerald Green for more than that, and both of them essentially flop. I actually want to get to Augustine, too, because people were decently excited about him. He had been a starter for Charlotte for a while. He had a good track record as a turnover-to-assist guy and as a three-point shooter, and he just didn't perform in Indiana. He was a mediocre offensive guy with absolutely no defense. There's a part of me that's worried about C.J. Watson, because even though he's played on good teams like the Bulls and the Nets, his assist-to-turnover ratio is almost identical to what D.J. Augustine's was. He's a little bigger, not much, and his three-point shooting is about the same career-wise as D.J. Are we sure, absolutely sure, that C.J. Watson's going to be an upgrade over D.J. Augustine, besides the fact that they're paying him half what they did D.J.?
I was asked virtually the same question when I was on the radio on 1260 WNDE with Jay Query and Derek Schultz. And they basically repeated verbatim your concern. Is C.J. Watson really better than D.J. Augustine? And so I'll sort of rehash what I said to them, is that I'm convinced that he is for a couple of reasons. It's not the case that they're virtually the same shooters. C.J. Watson, for his career, has been a good to great three-point shooter throughout. And coming to Indiana, Augustine's numbers in 4 years in Charlotte were very mediocre, 34-35% for his career, which is, you know, basically league average in the NBA. And his other numbers, you know, whether it be at the rim or mid-range, were just horrible. It was basically like, why is this guy taking shots? With Watson, he's not going to get to the basket, but he knows his limitations, and he's going to shoot threes. And he doesn't pick up assists. He's not a drive and kick guy. He's not going to, you know, be a real dynamic, you know, Steve Nash lookalike. But his turnover numbers, if you isolate those from his assists, are typically better than Augustine's. And as you point out, he's been a part of some really good benches in Chicago. He's part of a pretty good bench with Brooklyn, certainly helped them win games. He knows who he is. I don't know if DJ Augustine ever felt he had a future in Indiana. He was a really hyped guy at the University of Texas coming out of high school. I think he still felt he had a future as a starter in this league, and it was a huge adjustment for him to come off the bench. And I just don't know if he ever really took to it. But I think Augustine's going to be here, or excuse me, not Augustine, C.J. Watson will be here for 2 years. He seems like a really, you know, from what we saw at his press conference and what he does on his social media accounts, he seems like a really good guy and personality and sort of a little bit more outgoing than Augustine is. So I think it's going to work out. I'm convinced. You know, I understand if other people think C.J. Watson isn't a world beater, and he's not a world beater, but the Pacers don't necessarily need that from their backup point guard. They just need him to be solid, and I think C.J. Watson is a very solid player.
Is C.J. Watson essentially the kind of guy the Pacers are looking for as a backup point guard? Because at the time coming in, I liked Augustine. The 2 years he had with Charlotte, his two more recent ones, were more high usage. In his rookie year, he shot better than 40% from three. His second year, he shot just shy of 40% from three. I thought he'd have a chance to replicate that with having some of the onus taken off of him. C.J. Watson hasn't had onus put on him, so I think we know what we're going to get from him a little more than we did Augustine. But my other question with him, going from Chicago and Brooklyn, his last two stops, where he was asked to take on more of an off-guard role. I mean, he plays point guard, but doesn't always bring the ball up the floor. He's not dominant. That seems to fit a lot more what the Pacers try to do with their point guards, because as much as they give it inside, they dump it around the edge, Paul George and Danny Granger or Lance Stephenson, the point guard's more of a caretaker than anything, which he's done well. Is C.J. Watson, in that regard, a good fit for this team? Because it looks to me like that's something that the Pacers were targeting in him. And the only thing that I question are the shooting numbers that he has. But when it comes to caretaking, I feel a whole lot more confident with him in that backup guard role.
I think you're absolutely right. I think he's, again, we talked about Scola being a reasonable replication of what West does. I think C.J. Watson, there's a much bigger gap between C.J. Watson and George Hill, obviously. But C.J. Watson is going to do similar things on offense, to wit, mostly spot up. The Pacers do not use their point guards in such a way that it's one pick and roll after another. You know, they're asked to create offense late in the shot clock. They're just not that type of team. And C.J. Watson is not that type of player. So they're a good fit in that way. I guess where C.J. Watson is most like D.J. Augustine, and fans will not like to hear this, is probably defensively. He's not as bad as Augustine, but he's not a good player either, and he's going to hurt the Pacers a little bit on defense. But again, I think that's something that you live with, because on offense, he's going to be the last three seasons, I think he's been at 41%, 39%, 39% from three, which is very good and a huge improvement over not only the Pacers' average as a team last year, but especially their bench shooting, which was at oftentimes just dreadful, between Gerald Green, who you've talked about, you know, Sam Young couldn't hit a three to save his life, and obviously Augustine slumped last year. So I think, you know, the C.J. Watson signing is something that they just need to fill a need, and I think it was the first transaction that they made in free agency. He was available. He was in their price range. He got a nice pay raise. The Pacers actually will spend less money on backup point guard than they did a year ago. So I think it's a good deal for all sides. But again, we'll see how it works out, because the NBA can change from year to year, and you never know. But I think Watson is about in the prime of his career, and I think he's going to do a good job. So we'll see.
Yeah, when the NBA draft came around, we spent some time talking about Solomon Hill. The only guy I looked at in the draft who I would have preferred a bit to Solomon Hill would have been Isaiah Cannon. He's about the same size. He showed the ability to hit threes. He had a decent assist-to-turnover ratio in college. He wasn't a true point guard, but the Pacers don't really look for a true point guard. Houston scooped him up, and I'm going to keep a close eye on him. I thought Cannon could have been a good fit rather than Hill. I guess that's something we can keep an eye on as the season goes around. I like Watson. I think we're the same there, and he's not an old guy, too. I mean, C.J. Watson sounds like a guy who's been around forever because he's been successful with the Bulls and the Nets in recent years, but he's only 29 years old. He's not even 30 yet. So I guess he's someone you can watch and hope to have develop with a couple more years with this team just to stay in chemistry-wise. I kind of want to change gears for this next question because you do a regular feature on Indy Sports Legends, quick thoughts on the Pacers universe, just a couple of things you put together and keep people posted, especially in the middle of summer, the dead period of the NBA offseason. Larry Bird made an interesting hire, a director of international scouting. Can you tell us a little bit about Pete Filo, who they brought in for that job?
Yeah, Pete Filo just came in. He was fired from the Minnesota Timberwolves back on May 8th when Flip Saunders took over as the new president slash czar slash dictator of the Minnesota Timberwolves. And he basically said to everybody in the front office, you know, just take a hike. I'm going to fill all these positions with my people. And so Pete Filo was kind of out there in limbo. And very quietly last week, the Pacers announced that he'd been hired in the front office to a position that didn't exist previously, which is Director of International Scouting. Now, that doesn't mean that the Pacers didn't have guys overseas and they weren't looking at foreign players at all. But the Filo hire is really significant because this is a guy who has been a very vocal advocate for, you know, what foreign players can do in the NBA. And oftentimes, you know, you can draft guys in the second round and stash them overseas, and you can get some good values. And we've seen Manu Ginobili and Antonio Parker work so well for the Spurs. And Pete Filo's whole thing is NBA teams are overlooking this resource. And so there was a time back when Darko Milicic was drafted as highly as he was that NBA teams were probably a little too far on the one end of the pendulum, where they thought too highly of foreign talent and how well it could translate to the NBA. And now things have sort of swung back the other way, where teams are looking at American seniors and American freshmen prospects more than they are foreign talent. And Pete Filo is saying, you know, we need to find a nice equilibrium. And he's going to be the director of international scouting for the Pacers, which is very similar to what he did in Minnesota. And if you look at Minnesota's roster, there are foreign players up and down the roster, and they have even more. I checked on the NBA keeps records as far as who has, which teams have rights to which players overseas, and the Timberwolves actually have about a half dozen players stashed overseas that could come over at any time. So I don't know that the Pacers will do something similar, but it's probably a sign that they're going to explore those markets more. You know, when Donnie Walsh was in charge, and he's been such a prominent figure with this franchise for so long, just decades, and he was not big at all on foreign players. You know, every once in a while there would be, you know, a Brezich or a Bruno Sundov or, you know, guys like that who would pop up, but nobody ever really in any significant role. And I think they might be saying, hey, this is somewhere that we can get better in our front office. And they scored a big fish in Pete Filo, who was founder of the Reebok Euro Camp. He doesn't run that anymore, but that was considered the preeminent sort of foreign draft camp for prospects overseas. And everybody who's anybody in the NBA would go over there when that was held in Italy and check guys out. You know, Pete Filo was on top of everything. So he's not a name that's going to get any headlines, but when the Pacers start approaching drafts differently in the next few years, again, they're going to be drafting, you know, as you well know, Jimmy, and everybody else does, in the low 20s for as long as Paul George is here, probably, because they'll be so good. They're going to have to find more creative ways to add talent because they're not going to have cap space and they're not going to have high draft picks. You know, the two ways in which you typically add talent. So whether it's stashing guys overseas in the draft or signing, you know, foreign free agents, I think Pete Filo is going to give them a leg up in that area.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for Stanko Barrick and Irizam Lorbeck to come over and do big things. Hopefully the Philo edition will be able to bring over some more positive guys. The thing that swung me was Pekovic a couple years ago. Nikola Pekovic coming to the Timberwolves. I looked him up, actually, while you were talking, because he was one of his big finds. He was the second round 31st draft pick, you know, the 31st overall pick, I believe, in the 2008 draft. Didn't come over and play till 10-11. And he's started 35 games in the straight in the shortened year and 62 last year. Last year in the 62 games he played, he started all of them, 16-9 for a guy who not many people were after, a second round pick, obviously. It would be nice to have another source of income. Larry Bird, a lot more familiar with guys around the States, and now a guy who can add the ability to look overseas and find guys there would more adequately bank up the system that for the entire time I've followed the team has just been one of the shortcomings that the Pacers have. They have not gone overseas very much at all and found successful players. I can't remember the last guy outside of Rick Smits who they were able to do big things with in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, it takes some work. There's no doubt about it, and you have to know how guys will translate. I mean, from the little bit of international basketball I've seen, the speed is very different. The athleticism is different. It's more of a skills-oriented game over there. And sometimes you have prospects like Ricky Rubio who don't play. And, you know, if he's playing, you know, what, 10 minutes a game in a really good Spanish league. You know, Ricky Rubio was a guy who everybody knew was I don't mean to use him as a sort of a typical example because he's such a rare talent. But, you know, a lot of talented guys will not play because they don't have as much experience or it's just things are done differently over there. And so if you don't have someone over there all the time, it can be a tricky area to sort of project and, you know, how's this guy going to translate to the NBA? You know, when does he want to come over? You know, is he going to be comfortable in Indiana? Things like that. I don't know if this will pay immediate dividends, but I think over time you'll see a few more international guys trickle in. And, you know, maybe it does pay off. Pekovic is just an outstanding player. I think he just got a big dollar contract extension for the Timberwolves, if I'm not mistaken. But
oh, he got a lot of money. He got paid.
Yeah, he's a center. They get paid, but he deserves it. And in his case, I'm not sure I didn't get All-Star consideration, you know, with the year he had, but that's an aside. I think there are guys out there that can help the Pacers, you know, with the system that they play. I think it would fit some international players, and you know, it's not a huge market, but it's a cold weather city, so you know, somebody from Russia might be comfortable here. And once you start sort of going down that path, you know, I think international players are always more comfortable playing alongside other international players. So San Antonio sort of has that culture. Phoenix did for a while. Minnesota has it, or at least did have it during the Philo era, which lasted 8 or 9 years. I think he was there. So, you know, it always helps. You know, you can't say I'm not going to explore this path for talent because the Pacers are a small market team. They have limited resources. They usually lose money each year, and they don't have the ability to go far into the luxury tax, so they've always got to keep their doors open. And I don't know if there's anybody who has more knowledge of foreign talent in the NBA than Pete Philo does, and so he'll come to the front office and he'll just be a great fit, I think.
As long as Larry Bird doesn't decide to bring David Kahn to town with him, I'm totally okay with the Philo signing.
What's he doing these days? Is he going to TV?
Maybe. I don't know what he's doing. Maybe we'll have to have him on next week. I want to hear David Kahn's side of the story addressing the Pacers. Maybe that's the other thing, and that's something for another show. I would love to know the source of animosity between Kahn and the Pacers for all those years. It's about time, unfortunately, Chris, to let you go. We're coming up on the 45-minute mark. I know you got to get going, but I first want to ask if you have anything to plug. Cup upcoming on Indy Sports Legends.
Well, this is, it's non-Pacers related, but we do have a big Pacers project that we're working on that should be released sometime before the start of training camp, and I don't want to give any hints, but it's going to be a great project, and I think fans are going to love it. But it's ongoing. In the immediate future, we have this week a lot of Indiana football preview content coming. We cover Hoosiers football, and that will be up on the site. So we've got Notre Dame stuff. We've got a lot of high school football coverage coming tomorrow. So we invite fans to check us out, IndySportsLegends.com. Follow us on Twitter. Like us on Facebook. Do all that good stuff. And we're a pretty comprehensive website. And as always, we appreciate people reading. And I definitely appreciate you having me on. It was fun.
It was. That's Chris Goff at Pacers Scribe on Twitter. Chris, make sure you send somebody to that Chatard Brebeuf game tonight. Should be a good time.
Hey, we're on it.
That's what I like to hear. Sounds good. All right, folks, that's going to do it for us here at IC Squared. Be sure to check back next week. We'll have another guest. Again, it's a new regular podcast on Indy Cornrows. For Chris Goff at Pacers Scribe, I'm Jimmy Cavanaugh saying check us back next week. Good night. Travel well, folks. Thanks for listening.